Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Happy 4th of July weekend. And by the way, if you have an opinion, concern, or comment today's program, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. For the first hour, it's Free for All Friday, and as you all know, that's where you can call in on any issue that is important to you. It starts out with usually sort of throwing a question out there, but it can go anywhere you want it to go. And I'll throw this question out in just a moment. Is Senator Patrick Leahy in political trouble? I'll give you some reasons why he should be concerned and some reasons why he shouldn't. And leave it up to you to weigh in on your opinion on the subject or anything else that is on your mind. After all, it's Free for All Friday, and that's what Free for All Friday is all about, to listen to some of the things that are on your mind. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, I'm looking forward to this interview. It's with Woodstock author Mimi Baird, who has written a really compelling book about her father entitled He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. It's about a 20th century doctor, and it's a very, very raw and unvarnished account of his own descent into madness and Mimi's attempt to piece his life back together. And as a result, Mimi made a lot more sense of her own life. And by the way, this book is a Washington Post best book of 2015 and soon to be a major motion picture from Brad Pitt. And the screenplay is going to be, by the way, by Pulitzer Prize winner Tony Kushner. But let's start out Free for All Friday with this question. Is Senator Patrick Leahy in political trouble? Let's go to Steve in Barrie. Steve, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I want to comment briefly on your last two columns in the Times, Argus, Rutland Herald.
Sure.
2 weeks ago, you had a wonderful column about growing up with an alcoholic parent. And I have walked both sides of that street now in recovery over 30 years. And I really was touched by that column.
Well, thank you.
My second comment is about last week's column and should Donald Trump step aside. You brought this up before. I think we just have to accept there's a process. He will be the nominee, and life will go on one way or another. And my final comment is, I don't think that somebody who has served in the Senate for 35 years, is third in seniority, is in any difficulty at all. And, of course, referring to Senator Leahy. Thank you, and I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Steve, thank you very much. First of all, thank you for the compliments on the column about my father. I had mentioned that he was an alcoholic. The problem with alcoholism, it just doesn't affect the person who is impacted by alcoholism. It impacts the whole family and friend network that's around that person. And the problem with alcoholism is that it robs you. It steals the memories of your person because it overshadows the goodness in people. It overshadows what may have been in terms of that person's life. And you focus much of the time on the problems that the alcoholic has rather than some of the good things in the alcohol that the alcoholic has done. And one of the things that I mentioned in this Father's Day column is that let's concentrate on the good things for Father's Day. And I think, as Steve said, I thought it was a pretty good message. In terms of Donald Trump, the column said either step up or step out. Either you're going to run and run effectively, or it's time to get out and have somebody else run. And as Steve said, he thinks the process is moving forward. And the last one is the question today. Is Senator Leahy in political trouble? And here's some things to consider why he may be in political trouble. Is that, and you've heard it on this show, Bernie Sanders supporters are angry at him. And they're very angry at him for supporting Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. And one of the early indications that I got just how angry they were, not only the calls that were coming in here, but the fact that his state director, John Tracy, wanted to be the Democratic National Committee person from Vermont and was defeated at the Vermont Democratic Convention. To me, that was unheard of, that a senior senator's state director would be defeated at the state convention to be a national committee person. And, in fact, a Sanders supporter got that position. So that may be an indication that he's in trouble. There is this anger at D.C. in general out there. And I don't think Vermont is escaping from that anger. Many people think that Washington is in chaos. And although many people don't blame their individual senator or individual congressperson for that mess, they think Congress in general is a mess. And since Senator Leahy has been there since 1974, there are questions. And by the way, there's questions among the political left and the political right. I have a lot of friends who are on the political left, and they even question if Senator Leahy is part of the problem or part of the solution. There's polarization in Vermont that I haven't seen in years, perhaps since the Vietnam War. And it's mostly around economic issues. And politicians are getting the blame for that. And we've talked about this going back to 2008, where we had the Great Recession. And many Americans and many Vermonters blame politicians, blame business leaders for getting them into this predicament. And they're looking for others, for other ideas. And that's why you see the popularity of Bernie Sanders. That's why you see some of the popularity of Donald Trump. They're looking, and even if the ideas don't make sense in some ways, they're looking for a different approach. There's certain constituencies that are transitioning that the senator is going after or leaving behind. One of them could be gun owners. The EB-5 scandal, where the senator has refused to give up his emails, gives an issue to an opponent, an issue that will resonate with Vermonters. As you remember, we talked about this. Governor Shumlin has to release his emails. And most federal agencies have to release emails if requested through the Freedom of Information Act. Congress has exempted themselves from that act. And therefore, Senator Leahy doesn't. He's not a great debater. He's not nimble as a public speaker. Now, here are the reasons he may be not in trouble. He's an incumbent. And in Vermont, we do not throw out incumbents. Think of the last time we've thrown out an incumbent. It was Dick Mallory. And he really wasn't an incumbent. He was stepping up into the Senate seat. Senator Leahy has a vast organization with experience and money. Although he hasn't been challenged in years, and maybe his campaign staff is a little stale in how they're responding, because they have been responding somewhat sluggishly, and not really to the point of the various criticisms that have come. But make no mistake about it, he has a vast campaign organization. It's experienced, and it has a ton of money. The other thing that Senator Leahy has going for him is that Trump is at the top of the Republican ticket. Now, any Republican's going to have a tough time in Vermont. But with Trump at the top of the ticket, a Republican opponent to Senator Leahy is going to be tied to Trump. In many ways, tied more to Trump than anybody else on the Republican ticket if you're running for the U.S. Senate. The last time the congressional delegation had a Republican was Jeffords. And as you all remember, Jeffords switched to be an independent, caucused with the Democrats. So there hasn't been a Republican who has done well at the federal level. And although Scott Milne, Senator Leahy's opponent, is a nice guy, he can't match Leahy's money and power. And seniority, as the first caller talked about, can bring home the bacon, can bring to the state a bunch of surrogates, both actors and everybody else, that he may desire. That has a difference. And Vermont is a very blue state. So is the question today, is Senator Leahy in political trouble? I've given you the reasons why he may be in political trouble. I gave you the reasons why he may not be in political trouble. Would welcome your phone calls of what you think. Let's go to Fred Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, I'm probably off the subject, but I want to talk. I think your program should have a discussion about the draft, you know, or the draft volunteer army. I got out of the Army 47 years ago. And nobody had to thank me for my service. And the reason was because I thought everybody was in the military back then.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's free for all Friday, Fred, so any subjects on the plate here. But you think we I'm trying to understand what your question is. Should we have a draft or not?
Yeah, I think we should have a draft because thank you for your service. I think that's a weasel way out of it. You know, we have a professional army, and nobody's subjected to go. You know, you don't have to go. You can stand back and let the other guy do it. And, you know, they said the draft wasn't fair during the Vietnam War. I don't think the professional army is fair today. Why should less than 1% of the population have to pay the price to defend their country? I mean, is it an obligation to defend your country and to enforce the foreign policy of its leaders? Because that's the two things you do when you swear. When I took the oath, I took an oath to defend the Constitution, and then the fine print said you've also got to enforce the foreign policy of the leadership of the country. Would you agree?
Well, Fred, I don't know what I feel about the draft. I mean, I went into the service during a draft era, so I know during Vietnam, so I know what's going on with the draft. I kind of like the volunteer army aspect of it in that you really do have people who are committed to that organization. And in any organization, as you know, commitment is number one. So let me think about what we can do with that.
Yeah, but multiple tours of duty in a combat zone is like, can't do that. That's why we have all this PST, whatever they call it, all the problems these guys have, because they have to go into combat multiple times, or maybe even three or four times.
Well, the way to do that is eliminate the conflicts, but you and I both...
Yeah, right, eliminate the conflicts, right?
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, hey. I want to mention something else, but before I do, kind of a ditto there. There's an asterisk after that with Fred. But I'd also like to say a great danger in this full-time professional military is that we have created a separate class of citizens in the United States that are expected, they don't necessarily expect to, but they're expected by others to receive preferential treatment and preferential rights. And that's a danger. That's a huge danger in creating this this military class, which is answerable to the government. So there's a lot to be said for the draft that would kind of build up a wall between that.
Rama, I'm not following you on that. What special rights or special class are you talking about with the military?
Well, I mean, you look at the laws, for instance, that talk about how people in the military should, you know, they try to put in employment laws to give people coming out of the military preferential treatment and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole slew of laws about that that have to do with a lot of them economic. That have to do with this, as Fred said, this thank you for your service type mentality. That instead of becoming involved, we want to just, you know, create something special for somebody and let them know how wonderful and how heroic they are for doing what they're doing.
Are you suggesting that we eliminate those and institute a draft where we wouldn't have to have those because everybody serves? Is that where you're going with this?
In very general, with not really thought out this morning terms, yes.
Okay.
But what I also want to mention real quick, and young people, and this goes back to the elections, and younger folks really better be paying attention. I'm 57. If I'm lucky, by the averages, I'll make another 20 years. I mean, I fully intend to make another 50 or 60, but nonetheless, on the average there, if I hit my upper 70s for a male, I'm doing pretty darn good in this country. These younger folks have a lot more years to go than I have to go. And there is one political party in this country that will let the science of global warming and environmental degradation lead the way. Mm-hmm. And there is and that's the Democratic Party. There is another party, the Republican Party, that will outrightly deny the science. And even if they get back to a wall and can't outrightly deny it, they just throw their hands up in the air and go, oh, well, we can't do anything about it. So there's economics is one thing, but if we don't take care of this global warming issue, the environmental issues, economics ain't gonna mean squat.
Thank you, Rama. It's a little difficult to sort of broad brush that because we've had gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side who definitely have been in support of the concept of global warming and doing something about it. Let's go to George in Waterbury Center. We're all over the map today. George, what's on your mind?
I delete the thought of a draft because in Vietnam when I was there, half the guys they had training less than 2 weeks and didn't give a damn about anything. That's why most of them got killed.
Mm-hmm.
My stepdaughter just got back from Afghanistan for a year and a half there, and she was glad to have some professional people alongside of her instead of a draftee who didn't care because they watch out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen in Vietnam when I was there.
Yeah, that's my concern, George, when I have to think about this when Fred was calling in, that you know, a professional organization, no matter what it is, tends to be much more motivated, much more professional in a way. And as you know, and as you pointed out, in Vietnam, it was difficult getting that sort of commitment when people had 2 years. Now, on the other side, you know, Fred makes a good point. Think of all the multiple deployments our professional armies and navies are making right now. It is unbelievable and probably was unheard of in our day, George.
Right. Yeah, but today these people care is what my stepdaughters told me and my son's friends have told me to be Marines and special ops. And they said the boys care and their heart is into it and they trust the other guy next to them is watching their back. In Vietnam and the draft, that wasn't there because those guys didn't give a damn. And I believe it. I saw it. Those guys were there for 3 days and half of them were dead.
Thanks, George. I really appreciate your phone call. We're all over the map today, and that's okay because it's Free for All Friday. We started out with the question, is Senator Leahy in political trouble? We've done quite a bit here on the draft, which is, should we have a volunteer draft? Or should we? Wouldn't be a volunteer draft. Should we have a draft or should we have a volunteer army? Let's go to Dee in Duxbury. Dee, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. Well, I was going to make a comment about Leahy, but...
Go right ahead.
Well, no, a friend of mine didn't realize he'd been a senator for like a gazillion years.
Since 1974.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think term limits might be handy. But anyway, my son, okay, I was in the Army. My father was in the Army. My husband is in the Navy. My father-in-law was in the Navy. My son just graduated from flight school at Fort Rucker, Alabama. He's a warrant officer. And, you know, I mean, I think the military is great.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great thing. And he's all about the Army, and he's reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be going, he's going to school right now for medical stuff. But, you know, I think that's really great.
Well, I'm going to say something that Fred sort of disagreed with, but I think it's important to say. I want to thank your son and you and your husbands for their service, because I think it's important that we do thank veterans for their service, and I really appreciate their service. So thank you, Dee. Let's go to David in East Burke. David, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. In response to Ronald's phone call, there's no scientific proof for global warming, so it's very difficult for me to support that issue. In regards to Senator Leahy, out with the old, in with the new. He's old school. He's been there since 74. Let's get some new blood into politics. I don't like the way Washington is.
Thanks, David, for your phone call. It's an interesting point that you made, David, in that you said out with the new and out with the old and in with the new, because Peggy Noonan, who does a column for the Wall Street Journal, wrote an interesting column for today, and it says, a world in crisis and no genius in sight. Basically what she's saying, an old order is being swept away and political leaders everywhere seem to be lost. So it is an interesting sort of concept that you brought up. We're talking about a variety of subjects today, and that's what Free for All Friday is about. Bring up subjects that you are interested in. I started out by saying the process, but we don't have to keep on this, and we've had a variety of calls. Started out by saying, is Senator Leahy in political trouble? And I talked about the things that could make him in political trouble, and I talked about the things why he probably shouldn't be thought of as in political trouble, and I'm asking you to decide whether he is in political trouble or not. And then we got on a discussion about the draft, and that's fine on Free for All Friday, and that's the things that we do. Do you believe a draft is necessary or you don't? We should stick with our professional army, our professional service, as we have since the Vietnam War. And we've gone elsewhere as well. So if you've got an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We'll continue with Free for All Friday in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In the first hour, it's Free for All Friday. We're taking issues that are important to you. And in the second hour, we'll speak with Mimi Baird, who's written a book about her father entitled He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. Mimi is a Woodstock author, a longtime Woodstock resident, and also this book has really taken off and won the 2015 Washington Post Best Book of the Year Award, and also is going to be made into a major motion picture from Brad Pitt, and the screenplay is going to be written by Pulitzer Prize winner Tony Kushner. So it's a big deal, and Mimi will be a great guest in the second hour. In the first hour, we have Free for All Friday. We've been taking your phone calls on a variety of subjects. We opened it up by saying, is Senator Patrick Leahy in political trouble? And I gave several reasons of why people could think he's in political trouble and several reasons why he may not be in political trouble in the trouble category. You know, he's really peeved off Sanders supporters by supporting Hillary Clinton. There's this general anger at Washington and this sort of not being able to get anything done. And perhaps people view Leahy as part of the problem and not the solution. There's this polarization in Vermont, mostly on economic issues, but other issues as well, as people have talked about. He's got this EB-5 problem with the emails, and that he refuses to release his emails dealing with EB-5 gives an issue for a candidate or for an opponent. He's not a great debater. He's not nimble public speaker. But there are some big things that the reason to say that he is not in any political trouble. He's an incumbent. He has a vast organization with experience and money. He's not really been challenged in years. He's got Trump at the top of the Republican ticket. A Republican's going to have to deal with that, and that's going to be very difficult in Vermont. The congressional delegation, the last time they had a Republican was Jeffords, and he switched to an independent. He's got a nice guy as an opponent in Scott Milne, but Scott Milne doesn't have any money, doesn't have the power that Senator Leahy has. And Senator Leahy has the seniority where he can bring home the bacon to Vermont, meaning money, and he can have any surrogate that he wants in this state campaigning on his behalf. So, interesting discussion. Also, we discussed the draft. Should we have a draft? Are these multiple deployments? Are these the unfairness of who's going to war? Should that be eliminated by having a draft? Or does the professional army give us a motivated, more professional army? Those have been some of the discussions we've had in the first half hour. Your calls are welcome in the second half hour on these subjects or anything else you want to discuss. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Richard in Indiana. Richard, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. On the draft thing, to compare how poorly it worked and using Vietnam as an example, I think is a little unfair. It was a bad situation there. But then we had to have it, and it worked wonderfully, in a sense, for WW2. I think that some kind of compulsory service is not a bad thing. It would shape up some of these kids we have to get them away from the world of virtual reality to reality. I think a couple of years of service. And it might not necessarily be the military. It might be some kind of AmeriCorps or something like that. But it like Israel has done well with a compulsory service. And there's the other side. Obviously, a professional army is a good thing to have. So I think it cuts both ways. And on Pat Leahy, I was around when Pat was state's attorney for Chittenden County. So he's been around a long time. And you hate to throw out the experience, but, you know, there is a time when maybe you really ought to hang it up and retire and get some new blood, too. So I'll listen for your comments.
Richard, thank you very much. You're absolutely right. It worked in World War II much better than it worked in Vietnam in the draft, but we were under threat. We were attacked personally the country was attacked in Pearl Harbor. The Axis was an enemy that really had to be dealt with because they could have dominated the world and destroyed foes, including the United States. So you're absolutely right. It did work in World War II. We were unified in World War II, and it really brought us together in terms of what the draft, the support for the draft. In Vietnam, that was not the case, and in some cases in Korea as well. But certainly in Vietnam, it wasn't, and we saw the consequences of that. But when you deal with any organization, I guess, Richard, what you try to want, you want employees and military members, in essence, are employees. You want employees who are motivated, who want to be there, who desire to achieve an objective. And certainly we cannot argue that our professional army has performed admirably. And it's because of that motivation. It's because of that achievement. It's because of that pride that they have in what they do that I think is in large part helps us be satisfied that we have a very, very, very good military here in the United States. On the other side, I think there is some, Fred brought this up and maybe Rama brought this up as well, but there is some aspect that I worry about is that we sort of, the rest of us sort of sit back and want others to fight the fight for us. We don't have any stake in it. And that's something that I think we just got to be concerned about, because war is hell. And one of the things that you want to make sure is that we don't become so complacent. And I think that's what some of people are worried about with the technology nowadays. We run wars from afar, whether they're drones or something else. We run wars from afar, and we take ourselves and the emotions and the impact of war out of it. Let's go to Carolyn Glover. Carol, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment on Patrick Leahy's position. I voted for him several times over, but I won't vote for him again, because I think that by throwing his support to Hillary Clinton before his constituents in Vermont had even had a chance to vote demonstrated how much more allegiance he has to the party than he does to his constituents in Vermont.
Thank you, Carol. That's a prevalent feeling that I'm hearing out there, and it is very, very, people are really impacted by what that support meant. And Carol, I think you're one of those people that really feel that he sort of stabs Senator Sanders in the back.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol, for your phone call. We're on Free for All Friday, taking your phone calls. We're all over the map on the various issues, but that's okay. That's what Free for All Friday is about. We're talking about Senator Leahy. Is he in political trouble? I gave reasons why he should be in political trouble. I gave reasons why he shouldn't be in political trouble. Would welcome you to weigh in on this subject. Or any other subject. That's what Free for All Friday is about. And we've gotten into a discussion that I just didn't see coming. It's on the draft. And we've had a lot of people talking about that in the draft. In terms of, should there be a draft or shouldn't there be a draft? There are some that say, you know what? We should have compulsory service. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be military service, although we started out that way. But it doesn't necessarily have to be military service. And we've discussed the fact that the draft didn't work all that well in Vietnam in terms of having an army that was really motivated to fight. Now, part of it was the war and why we were there. One of the things I did disagree with Fred on is that we do need to say thank you to our troops, and we can't say thank you enough. And that's one thing that, as we go into the 4th of July weekend, although it's not Veterans Day, I get it. It's not Memorial Day, I get it. But it talks about our independence and what people suffered through when they went through their independence. I'll have a cup of mead, please. This is Open Mic with Mike Smith. I'd like to know what mead is as well. I've heard it many times in old movies, but I don't know what mead is. We're having Free for All Friday. It's whatever is on your mind to call in. Please call in at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Let's go to Gail in Middlebury. Gail, you're on Open Mic.
Hi, Mike. First of all, I would like to agree with the last caller about Leahy. I think he should have supported Bernie before he did Hillary, even though at this point, you know, I will vote for Hillary most likely, but I do think that he should have supported him. My second thing is about kind of the draft, but my husband was born and raised in Austria, and when they graduated from high school, every person, now at this point I think it was male at the time, they were required to put in 9 months of military service. Now they did a variety of things. If they weren't at war, they helped with senior citizens, and they did a lot of community activities. And our nephew graduated last year, and before he went off to college he had to do his 9 months. And some maybe join the military after the 9 months. But I think, actually, the kids actually felt a responsibility for the people in the cities where they lived. So I don't think that was such a bad thing. So I will get off the phone and listen to your response on that.
Well, Gail, thank you so much. I mean, there is no doubt that some sort of service does produce some responsibility. I mean, you've often heard me talk about what the service did for me. It turned my life around. I was a hooligan. I was awful in high school, and the service actually turned my life around, and maybe it does for a lot of people as well. Let's go to Diane in Williamstown. Diane, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Happy to meet you.
Well, I got to find out what it is. Ken Squire sort of put it out there. I got to go find out what it is.
Yeah. I'm commenting on both issues.
Sure.
The thing with Patrick Leahy, I think he is in trouble, and he should be. Because, you know, I'm not really necessarily a Sanders supporter, but he's the gentleman that won it fair and square. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the superdelegates, including the governor, are supposed to do what their constituents and the Vermont people ask them to do. And I don't understand how they can choose someone who is corrupt, still under investigation, still dealing with the FBI investigations, and, you know, that person is going to be having support from Vermonters? I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for that. And the second thing is about the draft. In Israel, all people are required to do 2 years of service in the military after they get out of high school. And that's male and female. And having traveled over there, you can't go into a restaurant or a small store or go down the street without seeing armed soldiers on every corner to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we may be coming to that point here in America. And I think the draft should be reinstituted. It should include both male and female. And the whole idea of medical disability as an exemption should be reconsidered, because to me there are plenty of stateside jobs answering phones, doing all kinds of computer work that can be done by people that can't serve in combat. But the military has you know, wide variety of jobs, not just combat. So I think because somebody can't run 5 miles with a 50-pound pack doesn't mean they shouldn't serve. And I do thank people for their service. It's vital to our country. It's vital to our safety. And I will never, ever stop saying thank you for that.
Diane, thank you for your phone call. We're talking, this is Free for All Friday, and we are on subjects that I expected us to be on. We're on subjects that I didn't expect us to be on. But, you know, that's okay. That's what Free for All Friday is all about. We started out by talking about Senator Leahy. Is he in political trouble? And I laid out why many think that he is, and I laid out why many think he isn't. And one of the reasons that I laid out the in trouble side was Sanders supporters are angry with him. You've heard them today. You know, anger at D.C. in general, the EB-5 emails, and the candidate himself. I mean, Senator Leahy is not a great debater. I think he would even admit that. And he's not as nimble a public speaker as other people may be. The thing that probably is going for him in Vermont, and the reason why he may not be in political trouble, is that he's an incumbent. He has a vast campaign organization with experience and money. He has Trump at the top of the ticket, and Trump will not play well here in Vermont. The congressional delegation has been mostly Democrat since Jim Jeffords, and Jim Jeffords actually switched to be an independent and caucused with the Democrats, and seniorities. Senator Leahy has a lot of seniority. Let's go to Tom and Barry. Tom, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, morning, Mike. Yeah, I had a couple things. Leahy, I think he's going to win I don't think he'll have much of a problem. Even he should have probably did the Sanders thing. As the fire truck goes by.
What are we There we go. Go ahead.
The other thing is on the draft, I think it's a good idea. I as somebody who hires people for, general work and stuff like that, this generation has a horrible work ethic. I've literally had people say they had to go to the bathroom and never come back, and no phone calls when they're not coming. And I think the military service could be a really good thing as long as it's done right, because I'm sure you know that no U.S. senator or congressman ever lost a son or a daughter in Vietnam. You know, not a one of them, because none of them went. So that would be the biggest thing, is to make sure it was, you know, the rich and the privileged aren't able to get their kids out of it. And that's all I got to say.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Senator Leahy, anyone with that much tenure, they shouldn't be there. There needs to be fresh thinking, new outlooks for our politicians, our representatives, because, listen, Mike, you've heard it. I believe it. It's a real country club political thing going on down there when you're in that long. And they get disconnected to the constituents. They're well too connected to the various committees and their compadres who they have hung around with for 20, 30, 40 years. It's good for democracy, Mike. And if someone doesn't automatically on his own step down after three terms, I'm always suspicious, and it's just way too much. Now, Mike, what do you think about Loretta Lynch meeting with Bill Clinton on a government plane for a half hour talking about golf and grandchildren, and I'm assuming maybe even yoga classes? What do you think, Mike?
Well, Rob, here's what I think. I was thinking, what the heck were they thinking of? Both former President Clinton and Attorney General Loretta Lynch, when they did that, she knows full well that there's an FBI investigation on Hillary Clinton's personal email account. And as a Justice Department official, she should not be meeting with Bill Clinton privately, and that's the word, privately, on an airplane. And the New York Times is reporting this morning that she is going to remove herself from the decision over the Clinton emails. And I think she has to, because the firestorm over this on both sides of the aisle is amazing. This, if this did not pop into her head, why this would not raise eyebrows, why this would not raise concerns, then I'm just stunned with this. Because this is like you're on trial and you decide to go out to dinner with the judge. I mean, it makes no sense. This was a clear violation of protocol here, and what the New York Times is reporting that she's going to do is remove herself from the decision over the Clinton emails and leave it to career prosecutors and the FBI director about whether to bring charges against Hillary Clinton related to her personal email. And this is something that I don't know Attorney General Loretta Lynch. I haven't really paid a lot of attention to her. But if this is the judgment of the top law enforcement official of the land, then I've got to question the judgment. So that's what I think, Rob, of Loretta Lynch's decision to meet with former President Hillary Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, why there's an ongoing investigation concerning Hillary Clinton. I just thought it was inappropriate. I think she now understands that it's inappropriate. She's removed herself from that situation, according to the New York Times. Will be announced later is what I'm being told through the New York Times, that it will be announced later that she will be removing herself from it. One of the things I just wanted to quickly, and we won't have time to take a lot of phone calls on this, I don't think, but one of the things that I just wanted to talk about, because it is something that you have brought up, and it's something that we may want to sit down sometimes, and I'll get some guests for the in the weeks, but it's on bicycle safety. And one of the things that WCAX did last night, they're doing this this special on dangerous roads, and one of the things was sharing streets with cyclists and pedestrians. But one of the things that you as callers have brought up, and I think it's really an interesting sort of difference, because I'm biased on this. I mean, I lost a very good friend. I lost the best man at my wedding because somebody fell asleep and crossed into the bike lane and ran over him, and he died. So I'm a little biased on this, if you haven't guessed already. But this article by CAX points out that it's both sides' responsibility. It's the cyclist's responsibility to follow the rules of the roads, and often they are. But it's also the driver's responsibility to give them some leeway, to give them some attention to what's going on. And you know, we need not to have happen what happened last year, where we had four bicyclists die. You know, we in cars need to really watch what's going on. We need to watch bicyclists. We need to watch pedestrians. And also as a state, and that's why I was questioning Chris Cole, the Secretary of Transportation, the other day, as a state, we need to do more public awareness, more signage, different roadway designs, and even bike paths in dangerous sections where pedestrians and bicyclists can be safe. So it is something that I knew would generate a lot of calls. I couldn't get to it today. We'll try to get to it in the future, but it has generated, because there's passion on both sides. There's passion on the bicyclist side that motorists are not being careful when they pass them. And there's one quote from a lady in this WCAX that says, sometimes it's pretty scary out there when you ride. She said she saw a person actually accelerate and buzz us, screaming obscenities at the time. So it is something to be aware of. Coming up, Woodstock author Mimi Baird in the second half of this program with her book entitled He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. And then we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for joining us today. On the line is our colleague, Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Victoria, good morning.
Good morning.
I've got to go here. British politics fascinates me, Victoria, because right now it is a mess. What is heck is going on over there? It seems like Caesar's getting stabbed in the back with various colleagues, in Johnson's right-hand person deciding that he's going to run for prime minister. What is going on?
Oh, it's backstabbing. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. It's crazy. Well, first of all, you have to go back 30 years, and you have to understand that David Cameron, the conservative prime minister, Boris Johnson, the former mayor of David Johnson was the Remain campaign, right? Mm-hmm. And he started the whole problem because he called for the EU referendum under pressure from Eurosceptic MPs. But mm-hmm. he called for it. It's his fault. Editorial. Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, also conservative, who became the poster child of the Leave campaign, and Michael Gove, the Justice Minister, also conservative, was Boris Johnson's campaign manager at the Leave campaign. He worked with Boris Johnson hand in glove. They were close, happy buddies. These three guys were all at Oxford University together, all close friends, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're all clever chaps. Okay, so they all went to Oxford. They're all clever. They were all close. And now they're all on different sides. And so you've got that going. It's very important in England where you went to university, who your friends were when you're in politics, things like that. So you've already got a split. You've got Cameron on one side. You've got these two guys on the other side. As late as 9:01 a.m. yesterday, it was thought that Boris Johnson was about to throw his hat in the ring to run for prime ministership because Cameron's resigned. And Gove, throughout the campaign, had said, no, I have no interest in being prime minister. I'm not qualified for it. I don't have the temperament. I don't have the ambition. I'm not the right person for it. That's not my kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly Gove makes this stunning announcement. I'm running for prime minister because Boris Johnson is not fit.
And that's what stunned me. Where did this come from?
It came from because he claims that he reflected and decided that Boris Johnson was temperamentally unfit to lead the country out of the morass that it's in, and that he just was not able to unite the country. Presumably, he thinks he, Gove, is, having said all along that he isn't. And so he stabbed his friend in the back. And he didn't alert him ahead of time. He claims he tried to call him, but of course he's got his cell phone and he could have texted him, but he didn't. And so he stabbed him in the back. Now, and by the way, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson are both former journalists. I just throw that in. He stabbed him in the back. And people didn't know this. Johnson goes out and gives his speech about to announce he's running to all his political pals, MPs, all kinds of things, and he gives a speech like he's about to announce he's running. And then he suddenly says, I will not run. And there's audible gasps. People start running around. Some people start crying. And there's journalists there, and these politicians start swearing, start calling Michael Gove the C word, audibly in front of journalists, British journalists. You know what they're like.
Mm-hmm.
I print it.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, let's switch to the labor side, because you got a labor leader who everyone is calling for him to resign, and he's not resigning.
David Cameron is resigning. Oh, who, the labor leader? He had a no confidence vote in the House of Commons, which your own party can do. He lost it. This was after at least 20 members of his own shadow cabinet, it's called, his own cabinet, which is, the opposition party has a cabinet. They all resigned, and after he fired a member of his cabinet for apparently launching a coup. And this is unbelievable. You couldn't make this stuff up. It's better than Game of Thrones and House of Cards combined. So they all resigned. He had a no-confidence vote. He lost it. And during Prime Minister's question time, which is the best thing on C-SPAN, David Cameron said to him at one point this week, for God's sake, go!
So, Victoria, what happens here? Because this seems to be in turmoil no matter what political party you're in.
Oh, it is. Oh, and by the way, Jeremy Corbyn, the far-left Labour leader, made things worse yesterday. He managed to start a fight with Israel and the entire Middle East.
How do you do that?
Well, it was at an event, and without going into the details, now, the Labour Party is being investigated for anti-Semitism. He compared Israel to the Islamic States, but it was misheard as comparing Israel to the Islamic State.
Okay.
So Israel went off.
Mm-hmm.
And then Islamic States took offense because they said we're Muslim states and we don't want to be compared to the Islamic State and we don't want to be compared to Israel either.
So he's got a mess.
Yes.
So where does this all sugar out?
Well, in the meantime, you've now got five people running for the head of the Conservative Conservative Party and the Prime Ministership, including Theresa May, who is the Interior Minister, who's a very steady, solid person, who the bookmakers have as the favorite. But because she's steady and solid, she might not win. Michael Gove, I listened to an interview with him last night, he's very smooth, very convincing. And even though the Leave campaign had absolutely no plan for what they were going to do if they won, because they didn't expect to win, he could pull this thing out. He could outmaneuver Theresa May unless she's able to convince her colleagues, because only conservative members vote for the leader, mm-hmm. that they need a steady hand at the tiller to lead them out of this mess, and that they need a woman. And she's got that going against her.
Well, Victoria, we've been talking everything British, but I want to wish you a great 4th of July weekend.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to a barbecue. I can't wait.
Victoria Jones, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Coming up, Mimi Baird, author, and we'll talk with her about her book. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Woodstock author Mimi Baird. What a book she's written. It's called He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Barry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. This book is going to be a major motion picture soon with Brad Pitt and Tony Kushner doing the screenplay. Tony Kushner's obviously a Pulitzer Prize winner. This book is a Washington Post best book of 2015. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Mimi Baird. Mimi, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Mimi, just if we could just start out, because this is such a powerful book, and I haven't read the whole book, but I had the opportunity last night to look at parts of this book. Mimi, can you tell us a bit about who your father was?
My father was from Texas, Dallas, Texas. He went all the way across the country and was accepted at Harvard Medical School, which was amazing for a young man from Texas. He excelled and caught the eye of some of the more famous doctors at that time, who took him under their wings. And so he was able at a very, you know, early start to make it known in the world of medicine in Boston, which at that time was, this is back in the late 20s into the 30s, was the mecca of medical knowledge. And so he, unfortunately, in 1932, had his first manic depressive break. And I believe that because he had been exposed to Walter B. Cannon, a physiologist, and Dr. Albright, who was a endocrinologist, I believe that that's when he figured out that maybe his mental instability was biochemical instead of psychological. And then, of course, we go from there. But he was manifested all the symptoms of manic depressive psychosis, very bright, attractive, charismatic, brilliant. He even taught at Harvard Medical School the classes that he was supposed to be taking himself. And so I don't know how much more you want me to ramble on that, but that just gives you an idea of a bright star who became afflicted with mental illness but tried to solve his own problem by doing some very unique and unusual experiments at that time regarding his diagnosis.
I want to get to those unique and experiments in a little bit, but as a child, as you were growing up, what did you know about your father, and what didn't you know about your father?
I knew very little. I knew he he doted on me, believe it or not, and even took me to medical meetings. I was about seven when he finally one day never came home again. I have to say that because of the volatile nature of a unmedicated manic person, that there were dazzling days and then there were scary days. So a lot of my memories have been, repressed for a while, and now they're coming out as I started to work on this book. So he was a classic. Well, they call it bipolar now, Mike, but then it was manic depressive psychosis. So I just remember, the good and the bad, the ugly.
When did you discover that something was amiss on the in terms of mental illness?
I you mean with him?
With him.
Oh, I was too little. My mother just said he wasn't coming home, and I went out and rode my bicycle. I didn't have that, type of intuition or knowledge at that time. You do what your parents tell you to do. You go to school and you go to church and you go to camp and you play with your friends. And, I just knew he was missing, but I didn't know why.
And when did you discover he did have mental illness?
When I was older, and my mother, when I started to be maybe more persistent in my inquiry.
Mimi, you being persistent, I can't imagine that.
Well, it didn't last long. I mean, it didn't. My mother was so sparse in her response that, I just kept on with what I was doing. So I would ask a question now and again, but it was very clear. You have to remember the times in which I was brought up, that in a way children should be seen and not heard, and I knew my limits, and so I just proceeded along growing up.
So your father was institutionalized. He was in and out of institutions, and then,
correct.
And did it, and eventually he went through a lobotomy, if I read
at correct. The very end.
At the very end. Does what did you learn? Well, let's not go there yet, because the manuscript really brings out what you learned, I think.
Yes.
About those times. You talked about he was experimenting with some unique experiments. What were those?
Well, because he thought that what was wrong with him was not psychological, what he did was he went to McLean Hospital, which is the private mental institution associated with Harvard Medical School, of which he had been incarcerated several times. And, of course, he, his colleagues, he knew the people that ran McLean, and he would withdraw blood from patients who were in a manic state, and he would come back to his laboratory that Dr. Walter B. Cannon, the famous physiologist, let him use, and he would inject them into cats. Mm-hmm. And I think he started out with the smaller animals, but it was really his final paper, not final, but his first, his draft of what he hoped he could finish, which he couldn't because he was ill, indicated rabbits. And he kept track of how long they lived, what their activity was, et cetera. And I'm not a medical person, so I can't give you an analysis of it, but just to give you a broad brush, that it showed, increased activity, shall we say, mm-hmm. in animals.
We're speaking with Woodstock author Mimi Baird, and we're talking about her book, He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. The one thing, Mimi, that as I sort of flip through this, the manuscript that you discovered of your father's is pretty graphic about life in the mental institution.
Correct.
How did you discover that manuscript?
Well, I was working, Mike, at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, And I think I was doing that when I first met you a number of years ago. And I, first of all, had, it will say in the beginning of the book, that because my mother didn't talk about my father, his colleagues didn't talk about my father, nobody talked to me about my father, that in 1991, when Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center moved from Hanover to Lebanon, we were celebrating. I worked in the office of, I was the plastic surgery office manager, and one of the retired physicians, I was talking, had a chance conversation with him, and he told me that he knew my father, and I was 51, 52 at the time, and that was absolutely astounding information. So I realized that all those years of not my father being around, but I just had a feeling in my bones that there was more to my father's life than I was allowed to know. And so 2 years after I talked to this doctor, so that would have been 93, I went out to Dallas, Texas for a plastic surgery meeting. And I knew that my father had a younger brother, and so who obviously was probably still alive. His name was Philip Baird. So I called him on the phone, and we got together. He talked about how he felt about, he thought my mother abandoned my father, and that they, you know, the Baird family had to take care of my father after his lobotomy. So he wasn't too happy when he first met me, but we sort of buried the hatchet. I told him my side of the story, and just as he was leaving, he said, oh, by the way, your father wrote a manuscript about one of his incarcerations in Westboro State Hospital, and my son, my youngest son, has it. So he gave me the telephone number of Randy Baird, my first cousin, who I'd never met. And I talked to him several times on the telephone while I was at the meeting. And then about 10 days, 2 weeks after I returned to Woodstock, where I live, the manuscript arrived on my doorstep.
I want to talk about that manuscript in just a moment. We're speaking with Woodstock author Mimi Baird about her book, He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. I want to talk about that manuscript in just a moment. Mimi, we have to take a short break here. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Woodstock author Mimi Baird about her new book entitled He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. And obviously the daughter is Mimi Baird. Mimi, what I was struck with, and we're talking about now that you've found the manuscript, you start to open up the box and look at the manuscript. The one thing that I was struck about, obviously the manuscript is in your book throughout the book, but one of the things that I was struck about, first, your father was very articulate in terms of how he wrote, and he was pretty graphic about the life in mental institutions. Was there one passage that struck you where it sort of took your breath away?
Well, it just there are many, but one, do you want to know, you see, it's hard to answer that in a way, Mike, because you've got to remember when, as beautifully as he writes, he's writing as he is manic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that his hallucinations, which I put a lot of them together, were some of the most fascinating things. Like my thoughts wandered with all anchorage eliminated. It seemed that I must have traveled back through the subconscious impressions imposed upon the origin of man, the nature of his soul, and the nature of eternal life. Here's another one. Perception of color became intense. The lips of most of the patients looked intensely red, unnaturally so, as if they had a coating of very dark lipstick. I think one of the most, here's one that gives you an idea of what he was experiencing as he was there, was my imagination took on the speed of light. I thought the entire Westboro region had been in some way detached from Earth and was catapulting through space like a rocket ship. So it's those kinds of things, and as you read the book, he's very specific about every detail and describing a straitjacket or describing a wet packed sheet experience, describing the people that took care of him, which were rough and mean. It was hard to be a doctor in an institution. Very hard.
And that's what that leads to my next question, because you absolutely you hit it on the head here. It was rough being in those institutions in those sort of days. Was there any point where you just became angry at the treatment?
No, I set out to have no angst, because I realized the reality of the situation. And it was the war years. A lot of the people that would maybe have more talent and compassion and care for people that were mentally ill weren't there. They were serving their country, or they were in a medical unit or whatever. So the people that were taking care of him were a little bit, substandard. So the situation was the way it was, and I didn't feel angry. I just felt, terribly sad and terribly empathetic and absolutely astounded at how he was able to survive it all and to write about it and to, when he was okay, to interact with the other patients. And he did treat the personnel with respect as best he could, but I didn't get angry because it was the way it was, and I didn't want to present an angry book or angry sentences or anything of that nature. I wanted to present the facts, because that's what my father wrote about.
I mean, in nowadays terms, it would be described as torture. I think it would be that's sort of what your father went through at the mental institution. Can you describe some of the things that he did go through? I mean, the straitjackets, the beatings, those sort of
things. It was the only, that's the thing that we have to, it is torture, but it's the only thing they knew, Mike. This is the only, that's why when the idea of a lobotomy was presented in 1949, the psychiatric world was so, it just embraced that, because nothing else was working with the knowledge that they had back then. Starting from the very beginning, the first things that he experienced were the straitjackets. And I think one of the things that we learn through my father's writings, that the treatments that he was given were the very treatments that were completely shouldn't have been done with a mentally ill person, at least of a manic type. Let's talk about manic here. You're full of energy, and you have to be, busy every minute, and you're rushing here and there. And to be put in a straitjacket is very confining, even for a person who's perfectly fine, because you're helpless and you can't move, and they put him in a straitjacket so that he wouldn't harm them. But he kept getting out of them. So they resorted to a technique called constant restraint, which was a combination of straitjackets and then the wet pack sheet business. They would get you out of the straitjacket, and then you would lie down on a mattress covered with a rubber sheet and lie on there on a series of sheets that had been soaked in ice-cold water. And then they would wrap you like a mummy and then attach, you know, you to the bed. And, you know, that was a horrible thing. And as he says in the book, the feeling of the cold of the wet-packed sheets on the spine was absolutely almost intolerable. Mm-hmm. And then you have the business of having to go to the bathroom and all of those kind of indignities, and, you know, one thing leads to another. He also experienced, you know, ECTs, which is your electric shock treatments. When he was in Galveston, Texas, he had quite a lot of those, and they didn't do any good. So when you list all the, and then there was one, insulin, that was it. And then the other one was insulin treatments, and those are given to you to try to just put you in sort of a daze. You know, you're not asleep, but you're not totally awake. And lo and behold, in 1940, and none of these, you know, they don't work because we know that it's a chemical problem, so you need to have medication, but they didn't know that then, biochemical. Mm-hmm. And then along comes Walter Freeman, a neurosurgeon who had learned in Europe about lobotomies from Egas Moniz, who actually that year won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, hard to believe, and came. So Walter Freeman traveled the country and the United States and went to all the state hospitals, and he arrived at Galveston in October of 49, and my father had a lobotomy in 2 months later. And we know those are now outlawed, mm-hmm. Except in case of, if you were in an automobile accident and you had extreme trauma to the head, they have to go in and do things like they do with a lobotomy just to save your life. But so he was exposed to everything that they had at their disposal at that time.
Mimi, he died in 1950. He had the lobotomy in 1949. He died in 1955 after a...
Died in 59, 10 years later.
59, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
After a seizure, and he drowned in the bathtub. Is that correct?
Correct. One of the byproducts of a lobotomy is seizures, or any type of head surgery that you it's just you can't go into your brain and be normal afterwards. And so the only medication they had back then for seizures was Dilantin, and of course he forgot to take his Dilantin, and he was working in Detroit. He was working at the emergency room that a colleague of him had gotten him a job there, and he lived in a tenement and was in the bathtub and had a seizure. So it was a very sad ending to a man that had great potential, obviously.
We're speaking with Mimi Baird about her book, He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird. When we come back, Mimi, I want to talk about how this process changed you. This is this okay. is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to be speaking with Woodstock author Mimi Baird. And we're talking about her book, He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. This will soon be a major motion picture from Brad Pitt and Tony Kushner. And it's a Washington Post best book of 2015. Mimi, how did this process change you, the discovery of the manuscript, the writing process? What did you discover about yourself?
Well, it's just sort of unfolding now. In order to write, I didn't set out to write a book. I set out to discover my father and do interviews and read letters and then found the manuscript and and all of that. So it was a learning process, and I took notes and then did a, you know, outline and had various people helping me just to sort of focus on the idea. But when I got down to brass tacks, I had to put that together at arm's length. I think we all know at least that with PTSD, which is what I have that diagnosis, that in order to move beyond trauma, because I was traumatized as a young child, obviously, and you develop numbness. And as my therapist said, Mimi, you're brilliant at numbness. And so it was with that numbness that I got this done. And I mean, it took 20 years off and on. And so now that it's done and I'm out, it came out in February of 2015. Now the paperback is out, came out in February of 2016. And I've gone to all sorts of places and talked about and read passages, and depending on who I'm talking with, do certain things, discuss certain things versus another audience. Hearing my own voice say these words and talk about the conditions and all of that, I'm just now sort of coming to grips with it. So it's in evolution, if you understand. You've got to realize I'm 78 years old, so and from New England, where, you know, the stiff upper lip approach to life has to be adhered to. So I'm just starting to figure all these things out, which is great. It gives me obviously a better sense of myself and who I am, and given confidence, and my speaking opportunities have been amazing. I've done grand rounds twice, three times, but recently last June, June, at grand rounds at Department of Psychiatry at DHMC. I recently gave a presentation of the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. I've been down to Vanderbilt Department of Neuroscience. I'm going out to University of Michigan. I mean, I could never have fathomed having the ability to do any of that, because I don't have the education. But I have the message, I have the book, and my father wanted his work to be out there. He wanted to educate people about mental illness. He wanted to try to defray the stigma and fear of people that weren't normal, but they have a disease. Mental illness is considered a disease. So it's been wonderful to be able to carry out his wishes.
Interestingly, maybe you can help me with this. As soon as your father sort of left that one day, did you ever have contact with him again?
No. Well, yes. When you read the book in 1952, and he didn't just leave one day. It was just more space between the times that he came home, because he was in and out of institutions.
Right.
So, and most of my friends were doctors, and doctors aren't around, so some of it was normal. Now I've forgotten what I was going to say.
In 1952, you said.
Oh, yes, thank you. 1952, he came back. My father came back to Boston for his Harvard reunion. And so that was the last time I saw him. I came home from school, and I got to spend some time with him and alone in my bedroom. And it was just like he, had been always been there. And then the next day he came back for another visit, only he had had a few cocktails, and my mother would not let him in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1952 was the last time I saw him, but I can tell you from my interviews with others, because I wouldn't have known this, that because of the lobotomy, I mean, my father looked the same, but he, his soul wasn't there, his character wasn't there. He was just a shell of his former self and his colleagues and friends, you know, were shocked. But I didn't know any of that.
What do you want people to remember about your father?
One heck of a brave man. I don't know how he was strong, determined. He was a dedicated doctor. He was a brilliant man. And it, despite all that he endured and went through, he still wanted to give something back to us as human beings. And he was determined. And I think that's one of the things when I get nervous, you know, about doing talks and talking with doctors and stuff like that, I go, oh, my father lived through those treatments. I can do this.
Did you ever think your book would strike such a chord that the book would be so successful?
No. I was just doing what he wanted. He says it multiple times in the manuscript. I want this to be published. And I also wanted to return him to his place in medical history for his experiments, which were 5 years before the paper that was written that gave the medical community the knowledge that that mental illness was not psychological but physiological. And I also, Mike, wanted in doing this, which I think has really been helpful to a lot of people, is to get families away from keeping secrets, keeping silent about things in their family. You know, that was the way you did it in the Victorian days. That's the way you did it in New England. And that is very detrimental to families, to have secrets being kept. So there are different layers in the book, which you will figure out when you finish reading it, that speak to different constituencies.
So the big question I have, Mimi, is have you met Brad Pitt?
I haven't, but he has two terrific CEOs. His company's called Plan B.
Okay.
They've done Selma, 12 Years a Slave, The Big Short, you know, all those wonderful things. They've never done anything in mental illness. However, I've had the absolute joy and pleasure of meeting Tony Kushner and being with him. In fact, he's due in Woodstock sometime this summer. But I've met with him twice, once in Boston, taking him around to all the places in the book, and the other when we went out to Westboro, the hospital that my father was incarcerated with. And I've got to tell you, he is one amazing person, kind, sensitive, brilliant. And this is going to be, in fact, do you have a minute and I'm going to read this to you?
I've got 1 minute. Go ahead.
Tony Kushner has signed on to write the screenplay, which means it's bound to contain all the timey elements that makes this story so brilliantly mythological. The ethics, the science, the history, the mid-century culture mores surrounding mental illness, and the limitations of heteronormative family structures, especially in the intelligentsia of the U.S. Northeast.
That's great. Hey, two more questions quickly. What did you learn about mental illness through your sort of search here with your father?
That it's prevalent, and everybody maybe has a touch of it. That, you know, we're human beings, and it's in our makeup all in different ways, and it sometimes manifests ways in one person versus another. But it is a disease and something that needs to be respected, understood, and taken care of in the right way.
Is this it for your writing career, or do you have other books in the works? And
No, good Lord, no. There's so much to do with this. This is going to keep me busy until the end of my days. There's tremendous amount of work to do, and it's a wonderful thing at my age to have the honor and pleasure to be doing something as helpful and stimulating for me personally, but helpful for many, many others. It's a total joy.
Hey, Mimi, where can we find the book? Just about anywhere?
You can get it on Amazon. It's in paperback, hardcover, and audio, but I recommend that everybody go to their local bookstore and support your local bookstores.
And the movie, any projections of when that's going to be made or come out?
Well, Tony Kushner has to finish. He's got to get here to Woodstock, and he's got to finish the screenplay, and then it goes very fast after that.
Hey, Mimi Baird, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike Smith.
That's Mimi Baird, who has the book, and it's a great book. I urge you to read it. It's called He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. I want to thank Mimi for joining us today. That book is going to be soon be a major motion picture from Brad Pitt and Tony Kushner. We all know who Brad Pitt is. Tony Kushner is a Pulitzer Prize writer. It's also a Washington Post best book of 2015. I urge you to go out and get it because it talks a lot about you're stunned by the conditions that people endured with mental illness in this country in the 1940s. And I want to thank Mimi. I want to thank all of you. Great, great program today with your phone calls. I really appreciate it. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, streaming worldwide at WDEV Radio. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for all your phone calls, and have a great weekend and a great 4th of July, and we'll talk again on Tuesday.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.